On today's College Football Inquirer, Fernando Mendoza wins Indiana's first Heisman Trophy, plus a thriller in the Army-Navy game. Also, we were waiting for the private equity deal seal to break. It is broken in the Big 12 with Utah and with the Big 12 itself. In other Utah news, Kyle Whittingham, one of the longest tenured coaches in college football, stepping aside, Morgan Scali will take over. We'll talk about the retirement of a legend, all on today's College Football Inquirer. This is the College Football Inquirer. I am Andy Staples here with Ross Dellinger and Stephen Godfrey. And gentlemen, we have a Heisman Trophy winner. His name is Fernando Mendoza. And he was pumped, jacked. He didn't say, "I want to flip in Heisman." I was hoping he would. I was hoping he'd call it back, but I don't know about you guys. I always enjoy the Heisman speech because I feel like it is the best window into these players' personalities. I feel like with Devontae Smith, he'd been pretty quiet and reserved, and we got to learn about him. With Travis Hunter, Lil Wayne is sitting there, and Travis Hunter's like, "I didn't even listen to your music until my girlfriend told me about it." And then you got Fernando Mendoza speaking Spanish to his grandparents, thanking dad, mom, brother. I just love that stuff.
Yeah, no, the one that I remember from, like, not a generation ago, but a long time ago, was when Mark Ingram was thanking the sports information directors at Alabama because, you know, it's getting a little bit better, guys, but not a tremendous ton where, like, we don't really get to see these guys' personalities. You know, this is why going to the NFL Combine in February was always really interesting because you got to talk to some of these guys that you might have covered for 4 years, but had been kind of gatekept behind the university PR apparatus. So the Heisman, weirdly enough, is sometimes the first reveal of a personality of a player that we've all known about for years.
Yeah, I remember going to you mentioned the Combine interviews and stuff like that. I remember going to the Senior Bowl strictly for that. Godfrey, because the Senior Bowl was pretty open with media, and it was like I'm you know, covering LSU for several years, and you'd go to the Senior Bowl to get players that I've covered for 4 or 5 years, and at the Senior Bowl weekend, I'd get them for longer than I'd gotten them for the previous 4 years combined. Right. So that was always good. But it was great story, right? Not just Fernando's story, but Indiana's first Heisman winner. Ever in school history, and obviously number one team, and just what they've done there, and basketball school to this football school. I ran into somebody in Las Vegas when I was out there with all the athletic administrators. I can't even remember who it is, and I wouldn't want to say who it is anyway, but I can't remember. But it was an athletic administrator at a school who told me that his daughter or son, I think his daughter, I can't remember, daughter or son went, is it like a senior in high school? And I was like, "Oh, where do they want to go to school next year?" He said, "Well, they want to go to a football powerhouse, so they're looking at Indiana." And he was serious. He was serious. He was like, "They want to go to a football school." But think about it, you know, when they started watching football maybe 2 or 3 years ago, Indiana has like emerged to this football
power. Well, Indiana was always one of the, because it's a very good school, especially in our profession. The journalism school is excellent in Indiana, and you'd see people from all over the country want to go there because they want the big state school experience. But a lot of the drawback would be for years, "Oh, but they don't really have big time football." That someone would say that a parent of someone who's looking at colleges would say that is a testament to the job Kurt Cignetti has done.
And you know, we always talk about enrollment and how enrollment is sometimes predicated off of like the success of football and the brand of the football program. And that's a good one little example of it right there.
Yeah, absolutely. I've covered, weirdly enough, because I did a lot of offbeat stuff, I covered a couple Indiana games before the Sig era. They didn't lack for natural interest. The bones of the thing were always there. And maybe we'll be talking about this as they advance.
Well, they didn't
the playoff
lack for investment either, because I remember going there. Actually, my last trip before the pandemic started, I hit Indiana and Louisville, and I'd been at the Combine, I think. So I went to the Combine, went to Indiana, and I remember, you know, going through their facilities, and thinking, wow, they are spending some money here. This is not a school that doesn't take football seriously.
No.
And then they spent $15 million to fire a coach, but they ended up getting a discount or something, right? I don't know. He resolved.
Well, maybe it was supposed to be 20, Tom and they spent 15. Tom Allen's just one of those incredibly good guys
that
will help you out. So. Yeah.
Also has not lacked for employment since then, too, as a defensive coordinator and had his services sort of sought after. Yeah, no, Indiana was always closer, I think, than people thought from all of the things that don't happen in the tackle football sense of the word. And then they were very, very, very far apart. Allen had them respectable, right, guys?
Like, yeah,
right.
They were in, I know 2020 has this sort of giant asterisk next to it. Yeah,
the 7-2 maybe season
but
then.
Yeah, right? the year that Penix upsets Penn State with the pylon touch, they go to, it was a Florida Bowl. I don't remember which one, Outback maybe? Like, they were not abysmal.
Gator. I believe they were Gator.
Okay, yeah, against Ole Miss, I remember that. And then, but I also, I wrote a, we did these mini documentaries at Vox, and I wrote one on that Penix-Penn State game. They still hold the record for FBS losses. Of programs that have existed for a certain amount of time, they are still the losingest program in college football history, and they are on the cusp, maybe, of winning a national title, which is unfathomable.
Yeah. They're the number one seed, guys, and no one is even complaining about it. No one's saying they didn't play anybody. No one's like, because they went to Oregon and they beat them, which I actually think, if I'm picking team out of the bracket that could do what Ohio State did last year, where it's like, not representative of what they did in the regular season. They just become a buzzsaw. Like that could be Oregon this year. But also they went and beat that Ohio State team that we thought was maybe a super team. Like Indiana beating Ohio State in the Big Ten championship game gave me confidence that this will be an incredibly fun playoff, that it won't just be the Buckeye invitation.
Yeah.
And I'm excited. But Fernando Mendoza is a huge part of that because, I mean, like if you talk to Cignetti in the offseason, he was going to tell you that they brought back all the most important parts of their team. Elijah Surratt, D'Angelo Pons, you know, they brought back a lot of that offensive line.
Mm-hmm.
But as good as Curtis Rourke was last year, they needed a little bit more. And Fernando Mendoza was someone that it's interesting because I'm actually surprised Miami didn't wind up with him because they were obviously in the market for a quarterback. Now, I think Fernando had decided by the time Miami really knew they needed one, because I think they were looking at Emory Williams, their younger guy, as potentially the guy, and then the bowl game disabused them of that notion. But Fernando's dad played with Mario Cristobal at Columbus High in Miami. Hey. So, but do you guys remember the other school that was after Fernando in the transfer portal? Big time.
Can't say
Auburn, Oklahoma? I don't know.
Georgia Bulldogs.
Georgia. Ah.
So the reason Fernando didn't go to Georgia is at the time there had been no decision on Carson Beck. He was hurt, but he hadn't decided if he was staying or going. And then Gunnar Stockton had not yet started in the Sugar Bowl. So the fear was in the Mendoza camp was that if Gunnar Stockton just lights it up against Notre Dame in the Sugar Bowl and they go on a playoff run, well, there's no open job. Right. So he went where the job was open. And man, did it ever pay off. And guys, I want to throw a stat at you. I found interesting. And it ties to something Fernando Mendoza said. So Fernando Mendoza at the end of his speech says, if you don't have enough stars, if you feel like you're overlooked, you know, just remember, if you work hard enough, if you have enough good people around you, you can do whatever you dream of. And it's interesting because 6 Heisman Trophy winners since 2017 have been transfer quarterbacks. 7 total transfers, if you include Travis Hunter.
4 straight. Yeah, I think 4, right? 4 straight transfers?
Yes, yes. Bryce Young was the last Heisman Trophy winner who was at his original school. But the first one, Baker Mayfield of that group in 2017, was the original, if you don't have enough stars, believe in yourself, blah, because he was a walk-on at Texas Tech. They weren't going to give him a scholarship at Texas Tech for numbers reasons. He goes and walks on at Oklahoma and winds up winning the Heisman Trophy. But I do think now, like the way the sport has evolved, I was talking to my son about this morning because there was a quarterback who lived in our town who actually moved out to California this offseason. And he was committed to Tulane before he moved. Trace Johnson's his name. And he won a state championship with Santa Margarita. And they're one of the best teams in California. And like, I looked at his rankings, like the 130th ranked quarterback in the country for the class of 2026. And I'm like, you know, if he can walk into the best school, you know, one of the best schools in California and lead him to a state championship, he might be better than that. So you just never know with these quarterbacks.
Are we implying that we need to recalibrate the analytics system around player rating, or is it just, Andy, do you think
there's anything you can do? Because I think the NFL has the same issue.
Yeah.
Spending clearly a lot more money.
Yeah, like, clearly.
When a quarterback jumps up a level, it's a crapshoot.
Yeah. Okay. That makes sense. It's just funny because, you know, the player rating services, as lucrative as they are, it feels like we're still in that kind of whipsaw effect where we haven't caught up on even understanding, like, hey, we had the number four rated class in the country 2 years ago. So therefore, in my old brain, I would equate that to X amount of wins 2 years later. Except if you're losing a third of that or 40% of that year to year, what does that even mean?
Well, yeah. I feel like the other positions, though, in the aggregate are pretty accurately ranked and they're fairly easy to evaluate. Mm-hmm. Quarterback's almost impossible. And there's a big argument back and forth within the industry about how to do it, because you have like the Elite 11 and the quarterback industrial complex where those guys will tell you, this guy's great. But like, you go to an Elite 11 camp, it's guys in shorts. Like, none of them are actually playing football. So
right. How
would you know? Like, actually, Haynes King was a huge football, you know, huge recruit, gets to Texas A&M. Turns out he's not that great of a thrower. Gets in that offense at Georgia Tech. Turns out he's the toughest dude in the world.
Yeah,
like,
right. And tough enough to convince me, by the way, to vote for him for Heisman. I voted for him in one of my three spots.
You did? That's
awesome. There you go.
Yeah, he ended up finishing 10th, I think. Yep. 9th or 10th.
I had Diego Pavia first, Mendoza second, Julian Diego third.
Yeah, I had Diego first as well, actually. Yeah.
And so Fernando actually, though, had a very wide margin of victory. He had 600-something first place votes. He was.
I was surprised at the distance. Yeah, between him and Diego, I thought it would be closer. And then everybody else was just really far. I mean, Love was really far down.
Yep. But Diego is another great example of this. Diego had no Division I offers. No, because Fernando at least got offered by Cal. That's a great offer. But Diego had nothing. And
I don't know the last time that happened, where a 1-2 and a Heisman voting were basically when it comes to ratings. You know.
Yeah. No. Well, and like Mayfield was a walk-on at Texas Tech, but Mike Leach had offered him a scholarship at Washington State. So like, he had an FBS offer.
I smile only because the people who want to just sort of absorb this sport from the 30 helmets that they know, the biggest part of it, you kind of have to pay attention now, because there's a chance that your next superstar quarterback is going to be playing for some low-end ACC team or New Mexico State, or, you know, like, this is how personnel is going to work from now on. I was not surprised by the margin on Mendoza, because the sports writer block that makes up the Heisman vote, they usually default to player on best team at the moment historically. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, if I had a vote, which I wouldn't, because I never would vote, it would have been Pavia, because I'm a little bit more of a believer, and I don't put a lot of stock in the Heisman. I kind of think it's pretty silly, but the idea of best player for, like, in terms of elevation of the team, my philosophy always goes back to 2010 Auburn was a 6 or 7 win team. And then the greatest player in college football history that year, or for that decade, maybe, walked in and won the
forever
national title. Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's the margin of elevation.
Yeah.
That I look at without Diego. Yes. Yeah.
Well, and if you put Diego on Ohio State and have him throw to Jeremiah Smith and Carnell Tate, they're going to be the best team in the country. If you put him on Indiana and have him throwing to Elijah Surratt, they're still going to be they're probably still going to be undefeated. Like, that was my thinking behind that. I don't know if you put Julian Sain or Fernando Mendoza on Vanderbilt if they're 10-2.
No, in fact, the two or three games I've seen in person of Vanderbilt the last couple of years were Diego authored victories over Alabama, over LSU. We just would not have this conversation about Vanderbilt if not for him. Now, do you guys think that Love took any decline in the total vote because of the Notre Dame bowl move? That was sort of predicted in some circles.
I think just look at Love's numbers next to Ashton Gentes or any next to any running back that won. Like, Derrick Henry's 2015 numbers, and he won the Heisman that year, are obscene. Like, there's no comparison. So that's why you have to be absolutely dominant as a running back. Like, you have to do what Ashton Jeanty did last year to even get in the real mix for it. And he still didn't win.
Yeah. I did also, I think I mentioned this on Thursday's show, I noticed for the first time ever, a lot of SEC or SEC-based or alumni journalists kind of really gritting their teeth at the idea of Vanderbilt having a Heisman before certain other programs. Part of that is because I live in Nashville, and I think a lot of the Vols were like, oh my God, this guy's
got... People actually care about that. I don't care Andy, who wins the Heisman or what school they went to.
Andy, more people than I realized going into this week, mentioning Diego Pavia. I was like, what the... And I kind of thought about it, and I was like, oh yeah, I guess you're right. Like, this, you know, this school doesn't have a Heisman. This school doesn't have a Heisman. Part of that is that I have lived in Nashville for almost 20 years, but it has really only been Big Orange country for maybe three of those 20. So, and a lot, those three are the last 3 years. So maybe they're just starting to wake up and find their voice again.
It's amazing that, and of course the NFLization of this has already started because that's the next step after somebody wins the Heisman is they go into the draft industrial complex. And so now I saw a tweet from my former coworker, Albert Breer at Sports Illustrated. And he said, Mendoza's personality will be evaluated thoroughly during the draft process. I'm like, no, it won't. He'll still be the first quarterback off the board. And I get it. Like, he comes off a little odd, but you know who he reminds me of? There's a player in the NFL now who Mendoza in college reminds me of this guy in college and then beyond college. He's Kirk Cousins, like personality-wise.
He's going to get paid, though.
I bet he shops at Kohl's.
That's a good comparison.
Yeah. He's going to make a ton of money. You just made the Mendoza family very happy, Andy.
Well, that's the thing. Like, Kirk Cousins, say what you will, and Godfrey's a Falcons fan, so we know where he's at on this.
Thousand-yard stare.
You should be happy about Thursday night. But,
yeah,
Kirk Cousins has been a very good NFL quarterback, and if you'd taken him as a high first-round pick, you'd still be comfortable with the production you've gotten out of him. As in an NFL. Right now, I looked at Tankathon. Unless it looks like the Giants or the Titans may get the first pick, neither of them need a quarterback. So they'll either trade out of that or they'll win another game and they'll be out of it. But the Raiders look like the quarterback neediest team with the highest draft pick right now. So, Fernando, congratulations on being a Raider. We don't know who's going to coach you.
But good luck on keeping your spleen, buddy. Okay, there's one interesting part of this that I do notice working in college media is that NFL-centric people, be it fans or media, they do start to ask us questions this time of year because, like, this draft setup is perfect for how the NFL views college. People are going to ask a lot of questions about Mendoza, and they're going to be these, like, really obscure kind of nonsense things about, like, character makeup, leadership ability. But what they're really asking is, are we going to have an NFL draft where non-quarterback needy teams – are going to be able to orchestrate a big picks deal for someone to trade up and then upset the entire narrative of that draft? If you had a year where it was a more household name or it was Ohio State's quarterback. So if it was Saiyan, if it was Manning, it's that simple too for a lot of NFL people. They oversimplify college. Just look at some of these draft classes. I think you're going to see a lot of people asking questions about Mendoza because of that, Andy. And it's really just like, is someone going to fall in love with him so much that they're going to bundle a bunch of picks and move into either one of those slots? Or have we become more mindful and they're just going to wait for him to drop and then some defensive player is going to be taken?
My guess is there's not that quarterback this year. Because Saiyan's probably the first guy off the board. If I were an NFL team, knowing who's coming out or having a general idea of who's coming out, Saiyan would be my first choice, but maybe not my 1-1. Like, my 1-1 is probably Arvel Reese or someone who's unusual, someone who has a skill set that I can't find anywhere else.
Yeah. And everybody involved wants a dramatic draft because it's a television event. So the questions that we get asked on the college side, they're very interesting and telling because they want to build a big storyline where, like, oh man, we're moving up to get this guy because he's going to be a world-changing quarterback. And they haven't had that the last couple of years where there's like a true superstar name that goes off the board.
Right. Cam Ward was a good quarterback. The Titans had the first pick. It made sense.
Yeah.
And actually, he's playing better as the season goes on, so it's going okay. Yeah. But it's a very strange dynamic. But I do think they are being more careful with the picks. They're not because remember when the Bears traded up to get Mitch Trubisky at number two and everybody who watches college football just laughed?
Yes.
I was like, I remember this Bears fan on Twitter got so mad at me when I said, why didn't you just get Marquise Williams last year?
Guys, this is my favorite hobby is to talk to otherwise highly intelligent, certainly well-compensated NFL media types and their interpretation of what we do gets so skewed. Do you guys remember when Ryan Tannehill was picked as high as he was as a quarterback?
Yeah.
Like, do you, what are you doing on Saturdays? I'm not saying you got to watch everything. I'm just saying, like, yeah, maybe check in with one of us before you make this investment. Like, this happens. I think we're good. We're good once a year for this at the quarterback position specifically. Now, part of this is that it's a quarterback needy and quarterback deficient league. And so college takes the blame. In fact, I'll make a prediction. And TJ, our producer, you can like memory hole this and we'll come back in April and talk about it.
Oh, you're going to make him mad because you're gonna say Dante Moore might be QB1.
No. What I'm going to say is this. There's already a discussion on like the whole draft Twitter world, like the hardcore draft nerd media guys, on a pipeline issue, quarterback development problem. And a lot of people are already starting to wag their fingers. You know, 10 years ago, I got into an argument with Pete Prisco over this because it was the zone read was ruining quarterback development. The zone read and some of the stuff that Urban and Dan Mullen were doing in the air raid, that was ruining NFL quarterback development, as if it was the job of the university to develop someone for the NFL.
For the pro leagues, yes.
I will take you back to a conversation I had with Dabo Sweeney in 2012 or 2011.
Okay.
And it has informed my thinking about this topic.
Okay.
Dabo was complaining because there were guys, they couldn't find a quarterback who could take a snap under center. None of the quarterbacks in high school took snaps under center anymore. And so it was a very hard thing when they got a quarterback to teach him to take snaps under center. And Dabo goes, "You know what? I'm probably just not going to have them work under center anymore. I'm probably going to do what they do best. I'm probably going to have an offense that allows them to do what they already know how to do, because my job is to win games."
Yes.
Yeah.
My job is not to make them take snaps under center.
It's funny you mentioned that, Andy, because there was a huge knock against Michael Penix this year, who had so much success in multiple systems at multiple schools in college that he's not comfortable enough taking snaps in short yardage situations in the NFL under center. And he's not alone. There are other quarterbacks where this is an issue. But the thing I want to memory hole and come back to is like, we are going to get some sort of criticism as if like the three of us are responsible for it, that college is not accurately preparing quarterbacks for the NFL. This happens about once a decade, and it's because NFL offenses are not correctly identifying what they're receiving, and they're still trying to fit it to an outdated mold.
Adjust to your talent.
Yeah. Correct.
Don't try to make your talent adjust to your scheme, which is every good coach at every level understands that. Do you know who understood that first in the NFL with this crop? Andy Reid, who made Patrick Mahomes the first good air raid quarterback in the NFL.
Sub-500 Texas Tech program. Josh Allen, zero-star prospect, who could not get a preferred walk-on offer from Fresno State. That's why he went to Wyoming. These are the guys who were these are the guys who are leading the NFL. I know Lamar won a Heisman. Occasionally we get one right. But like, yeah, don't blame college. You guys have to evaluate better. You guys have to scheme better.
Can we talk for 5 seconds about guys that can take snaps under center, though? And I speak, of course, of Blake Horvath and Cale Helms in the Army-Navy game.
It was such a game, dude. It was such a good game.
It was a beautiful game.
Oh, man.
The first quarter lasted, let's see, it was 15 minutes of football time. I believe it was 16 and a half minutes of real time, which was incredible. Yeah.
I made the mistake of not finishing what I was grilling in time. And so it's like, you gotta be fast in the first quarter. Mm-hmm. Andy, famous football axiom, I can't remember who said it. When you throw the ball, three things can happen. Two of them are bad. Isn't that
that's right. Yeah.
Ross, you were there. The bad things happened and defined this game. Now,
the good thing happened then at the good end thing, on fourth down.
The pass. Yeah, the touch, the winning, the game winner.
Far too much throwing the ball for my taste in an Army game.
Well, I mean, this game was incredible because there were two fumbles by Navy.
Yeah.
That one hurt them very badly, and one could have ended the game.
Yeah.
They're near the goal line in the fourth quarter, but they jumped on. I think Heidenreich jumped on the fumble, I believe. But Blake Horvath and Eli Heidenreich, they made this Navy offense more dynamic. And that's why when Navy picked off Helms in the fourth quarter, I was like, okay, they're going to win. Because Horvath, I trust more. And look, I got a feeling pick was Army plus 6.5. That hit, I'm glad. But Navy was the better team and the better team all season. And you saw it at the end of that game. That play for the touchdown on fourth and goal was not something Navy could have pulled off before Drew Kronick was their OC.
Correct. Yes.
Right.
I'm referring more to the fact that an Army team that was clearly inferior in every way had a lot of lucky bounces, played the turnover game, honestly took advantage of Navy's mistakes. They're up 16-10. They've got the ball. I'm looking at it. Okay. They've got the ball on 2nd and 9 on their own 25 with 11 minutes left. Now, on Thursday, I said this team regularly averages 8.5 minute scoring drives. So had they just kicked a field goal, it would have been 19-10 with under 2 minutes left. And essentially, you've won the game, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
They throw deep on 2nd and 9 from their own 25.
You know what?
They handed Navy the game.
If you watch the end of the second quarter, Helms has this throw rolling to his right down the sideline where the receiver tightropes the sideline. And it was one of those, they had to have it at the time. They're trying to set up a field goal at the end of the half. Yeah. I think that made them overconfident.
Well, I think
when they hit that throw, they were overconfident.
There's one defense of the pass first mentality for Army. I wouldn't call it pass first, but pass more often was there was the no call in the end zone right before the half where there was clearly PI on what was probably could have been a touchdown pass or at least set them up first and goal to then score. And that ends up being the difference in the game from a certain perspective. If you just don't throw the damn ball, if you're Army, Army could have won the game by never throwing the ball in the entire second half. They would have won
the
game. Which
usually they do.
Correct.
It was weird to see some of the calls. By the way, yeah, this is my first like Army-Navy game and recommend anybody to certainly go. It probably exceeded expectations and the expectations were incredibly high. Just the fanfare, you know, everybody gets there like 4 hours before kickoff to watch the march on and all that stuff, and then they have the parachuters and the whole thing was just it was an incredible experience. And then because of personal matters, I actually left at halftime. I know I missed like the grind. I know I was in Ross. The car on the way back to DC for most of the second half, but it was like the whole pageantry before the game was remarkable. And I would suggest anybody, if you haven't been, to go. I'm going to try to even go back next year. I think it's in New York next year. So.
No, it's Foxborough next year.
Oh, is it? Yeah.
Ooh, may get some snow. I was disappointed because it is snowing in Baltimore, or supposed to snow in Baltimore today, I believe, but not.
It is. It's snowing here in D.C. Yeah, it snowed overnight.
Ross.
Snowed overnight in D.C.
They announced Foxborough. It is at MetLife next year.
MetLife,
and they announced
it's
Foxborough after that. Or not, that it's not called Foxborough, whatever it's called now. Patriot Stadium.
Yeah, we missed the snow, Andy, by, I don't know, like 8 to 10 hours or so probably because it snowed overnight here in D.C. and Baltimore started getting it, I think, late into the night. But that would have been, the thing is like of all the weather in mid-December experiences that you could have, this was about the best outcome. It was like partly sunny and 40, 45 degrees. So
yeah,
it was pretty nice. Yeah, it was actually pretty nice out and not very much wind either. So it was great. And what a state.
That
like, I've
probably
never been
made
to that
him
stadium
throw,
there.
Though. That probably killed Army in the game.
No wind. So let's
what are you
it,
doing?
Boys.
What are you doing, guys? Ross, it is it's weird to say this about an NFL stadium. But there is something about the architecture in Baltimore, where it sits relative to the water, and when it's cold weather, how perfect a setting that is for the Army-Navy game. I've done an Army-Navy at M&T Bank. And also, all the interior concrete of the stadium, it just looks like an old Veterans or Memorial Stadium that you would see in a small town. It works really well.
Well, I was captivated. I love it. My son's team runs the triple option, so watching two high-level versions of that go at each other was a lot of fun just from watching, you know, the simpler version all season and then seeing what it looks like when you have a bunch of highly intelligent, you know, best of the best kind of people running it. It was fun. Guys, we got to talk a little off the field because Ross Dellinger's broken a couple of stories in the last week that are highly, highly interesting. And you are going to want, even if you're not a fan of the teams we're talking about, you're going to want to know because it's going to affect your team pretty soon. Is the private equity deals that are coming to the Big 12. We'll talk about that when we come back, but I want to remind you before we go, if you'd like to watch us instead of just listen to us, turn on your smart TV, find the Yahoo Sports Network icon, click that, and you can watch all of the shows from the Yahoo Sports Network, including the College Football Inquirer, or wherever you are, any device, anytime, day or night, go to yahoosports.tv. You can pick us up on your tablet, on your phone, on your laptop. And you can watch the College Football Inquirer and all the Yahoo Sports Network shows anytime. YahooSports.tv. We'll be right back talking PE on yahoosports.tv. We're back, College Football Inquirer, and Ross Dellinger has been a busy, busy man. He was in Las Vegas last week with all of the movers and shakers in college football, and conveniently enough, they were moving and shaking whilst there, and Ross filled us in on everything they were doing, because when we finished up Thursday's episode, Ross was breaking the story that Utah was going to be the first school to take one of these big private equity deals where they're going to get a big cash infusion, and then a company is going to have an equity stake in the athletic department. And now comes news that the Big 12, and Ross broke this on Friday, that the Big 12 will have a deal where each of their schools has access to, Ross, help describe it. Is it a loan, yeah, essentially?
Yeah, it's so this deal is certainly vastly different, right, from the Utah deal, mm-hmm, and different really from the Big 10 proposal too. This is like strictly a private capital sort of credit deal, mm-hmm, and not an equity deal. And so there's kind of three parts of it, Andy. The first part, and it's with Redbird and Weatherford Capital, which Redbird and Weatherford have been trying hard to get into the college game. They've been pitching a lot to schools, individual schools, deals.
That's Will Weatherford?
And that is Drew Weatherford. Yeah.
Oh, that's well, Drew. Okay. I covered Drew in high school. Yeah. One of the best, mm-hmm, quarterbacks I ever covered in high school. Played at Florida State, by the way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this is kind of a combo deal between Redbird and Drew Weatherford, which they're partners anyway. And actually, Otro Capital, the firm that Utah is doing their equity deal with, is a spinoff from Redbird. So Redbird is very involved in all of this stuff. But so here's the deal is kind of three buckets that the Big 12 is considering and close to finalizing. It sounds like they're on the doorstep. One bucket is that there's kind of just a business partnership with Redbird, where Redbird will sort of work for the Big 12 to try to generate revenue and sponsorships and new ways to generate revenue at the league office. Bucket two is a cash infusion to the conference office so that the conference office can take that capital, and it's millions of dollars. I don't know the exact amount yet. I've heard upwards of $25 million, but that is not set or anything. And they can reinvest that stuff and use that to even create companies, kind of like the Big Ten was talking about, Big Ten Enterprises, kind of something to that effect. And then the third part is probably the biggest and most significant, Andy, which is, as you mentioned, each school has a choice whether it wants to take upwards of $30 million in capital and basically credit from Redbird and Weatherford, and then pay back that money over time, with a thought being that it would use its future conference television revenue to do that. So it's an opt-in, opt-out deal. It's an optional sort of deal.
So which is unlike why the Big Ten, where there was pressure to, yes, for everybody to do the deal.
Exactly. Yeah. In the Big Ten's deal, though it was part capital, it was part equity, right? Because UC Investments was getting a 10% share in the league, or at least Big Ten Enterprises, which would run the league in general, would be the professional sort of business arm of the league. So it was kind of like quasi-capital equity. And this is just a capital-like credit deal. And it's why probably it's gotten really close to happening here, where they're on the doorstep, because all schools don't have to do it if they don't want to do it, right? They don't have to take the capital.
It's the Big Ten, everybody had to take it. For normal people, basically, the schools can get a HELOC if they want, a home equity line of credit. It's like you can open that line of credit against your equity, and if you need to renovate your bathroom, you can draw from it. That sort of thing.
Yeah. And so right now, where we are in the process, they've been working on this they've been speaking, I think, with Redbird for over a year, maybe even 2 years, about a potential deal. And Big 12 Commissioner Brett Yormark, who's been, I think, behind a lot of this, his first, like 2 years ago, maybe, he brought a deal to his board, probably more similar to the Big Ten deal. And it just, it didn't go well. And they started to rethink it. Then he brought a second model with Redbird. And it, again, it just didn't go anywhere. And this third model is just, maybe you could say, a more relaxed version. And the optionality provides just the schools a little more flexibility. And it seems like they're pretty close. So last week, the presidents voted to give him, to take the next step, which was go from maybe a short-term like term sheet to a long-form agreement in writing these documents. And then it has to be voted on. And probably it needs, from my understanding, it needs a simple majority. So it just needs 10 or 9 of the 16 to vote in support.
So, okay.
All right. This is my favorite part.
All right. I love it.
Yeah. We are one of the first red flag among many that jumped out at me is that you would be taking this money against probably future television deals or revenue, right?
Yep. Yep.
Boy, does that seem risky in this market because we don't really even know what the providers are going to look like the next time this thing rolls around. The networks themselves are a very fragile entity at this point. I don't know if anybody pays attention to like telecom or what's going on in Hollywood with the consolidation of providers. The trickle-down effect of that is kind of amazing. Like if this pending deal with like Netflix and Warner's goes through and it's not Paramount and Warner, like there are going to be less people at the trough feeding, which is sort of, I'm mixing metaphors here because, you know, Andy said it's a HELOC, which is probably the best way to explain it, except that it seems like a very big risk even from the PEVC side of this, because what is the potential value in 10 years of a Big 12 that this Big 12, as we know it, doesn't have really a lot of history, right? Doesn't have a lot you can bank on. This feels alarming on both sides, whether I'm borrowing or lending in this case. Well, stating the obvious.
No, and you make a good point. The big question is, you know, if you're borrowing off of future TV revenues, what are your TV revenues going to be? Where is this going to go in a state that's so uncertain right now? When you redo your TV deal, where will it be compared to the current TV deal in this market where we have the streamer situation and obviously the Big 12 lost two of its biggest brands and all that stuff, I think, is a question. And I think that's why when they first brought the original proposal, it was more like the Big 10 where everybody had to do this and everybody didn't want to do it, clearly. And so now it's like an option. So you're going to see, I'm guessing, 4 to 6 schools probably, if they do get this thing finalized, aren't going to do it, right? They're not going to take the capital probably because of all the things you're talking about. But some of the schools, I think, are in a position, and here's an example, Kansas State gets no money from the university for revenue share. There's no increase that has happened. While a lot of these schools, you've seen an increase, Iowa State's another example of that. Mm-hmm. You've seen an increase from their university funds. Like Kansas State and Iowa State are two good examples of they're getting zero when West Virginia is getting, you know, whatever, 8 to 10. And we've seen, you know, go to the SEC, Ole Miss is getting this similar, and they're getting zero. And I think they would be some of the ones that will take this.
What scares me? Go ahead, Andy.
How much of this, and the Utah one, which is a, like you said, a different deal, is a more of a pure equity deal. How much of this is to catch up with Texas Tech and what they've been able to do this year?
Well, Texas Tech and the SEC and the Big Ten certainly to try in the way to close that gap. But I think that's a good point, right? Texas Tech feels like it has been head and shoulders financially and resource wise above everybody the last couple of years in the Big 12. They're spending, Texas Tech is spending, you know, Ohio State money on their roster. While everybody else in the Big 12 is far away
so
from
far.
That. Yeah. That's the thing. Like the thing is if it didn't work, Andy, there would probably be another a different view of this going forward.
We'd be covering a coaching search at Texas Tech right now if it hadn't worked.
That's true.
Correct.
And then last year for Ohio State it worked. right? And this year for Ohio State, it's working. Like you can see that, obviously, look what A&M's doing too. I mean, you could see, now there are some outliers that aren't spending as much as others that find themselves in the playoff, and Indiana is probably a good example of that. Right?
So two things,
probably the best example of that. Well, I think
they're spending some money on something, but it's Kurt Cignetti.
Two things that scare me the most. One is this constant banking upon the television revenue number going up. This feels a lot like, if you've ever read The Big Short, this feels like, oh, a mortgage-backed security is the safest bet in all of Wall Street, until it's not. And we are
sorry. This doesn't work unless it's Margot Robbie in a bathtub explaining it to me.
Well, hang on.
Don't do that.
The simplest way to explain this is that if you're seeing a sort of micro recession going on in the revenue streams in Hollywood, in the service providers that then turn around and pay for live sports to appear on their platforms. It used to be networks, now it's streamers. The trickle-down effect of that is real. And by the time that a lot of these re-ups are coming, I don't think that the bottom is going to fall out of television revenue entirely, because live football is so powerful. But the people that are willing to ante up and write those checks are becoming fewer and further between.
Godfrey, it's not like those entities are consolidating at a very quick rate.
I mean,
it's not like there was a huge story last week about two of those entities consolidating.
I read a lot of this stuff in my spare time. If you go and read, just grab anything off Deadline or Variety or Hollywood Reporter or Puck or any of those places, and like it's really, really unsettling if you work in any aspect of media and entertainment, which we do, to see what's coming down the pike. Now, the second part of this that scares me is that I'm the college football every man, everyone should be at the table thing. But what I think is happening, and I'm glad that you guys brought up Texas Tech, is that we are now encouraging people to make bad, bad financial deals to try and keep pace with schools that's just not possible to keep pace with. If Texas Tech has an outsized ability to do this, if Ohio State, if Georgia, Florida, Alabama, et cetera, it is incumbent upon somebody here to manage the expectations, because if you are now borrowing against future television revenue and you're borrowing significantly against it, am I the only person here who's like, this is bad? Like I would short this. I would be Michael Berry if I could.
Yeah, no, I think it's pretty obvious. It's bad for most of the people involved. Yeah,
this is like, not a good idea. The Big 12 has no ability to stay. There is no brand. The Big 12 is not a brand. It's a current consortium. This is a bad idea.
This is sort of like when I found out you can make installment payments on DoorDash. If you have to make installment payments for a burrito, you don't need to be borrowing money.
Oh, I thought you
$1 over the next 3 weeks.
Yeah.
It's
the same thing. It's no different. Like,
but
in the realm where you can compete, you're not going to get there, and you can borrow a bunch of money and just put yourself in a deeper hole. Now, here's the thing, though. All of these people who are doing the decision-making on this, they won't be in these jobs when the bill comes.
Correct.
Well, that's part this
is
of
a
this.
Huge, and yeah. This is a huge problem. This is why all that dead money exists in coaching, too. Your job as the person who makes the call on the extension for the coach or firing the coach, you are not held to account for the debt ratio that you manipulate. You are going to be viewed on, did you make certain people feel happy in the moment? And then you get to keep your job for two or three more years. The short-sightedness of this is what's led to what it feels like a cliff, Ross. And if you can tell me that I'm being hyperbolic, great.
Can we just call these schools the burrito financers? Just as a group?
Absolutely.
Well, the point about, you know, these ADs, commissioners, presidents won't be there right when the bill comes due and 8, 10, 15 years is a good one. In a reason why that when the Big Ten deal got blown up there at the end was behind that, right? Because the board, remember the board members who are supposed to be like stewards who will be around probably in 10 or 15 years, kind of step forward
going to be around, but they understand their job on the board, and it's sort of driven into this institution must stand for 400 years. You must be a steward of that.
Right. They have a connection to the school. And even if they won't be on the board in 10 years, they'll, if they're still with us, they'll be alive and in donating to the school and contributing in other ways when so-and-so AD is moved on to another school, retired, or got fired.
Yep.
I just don't know of like what. Okay. I know we need to move on. the Big 12, I keep going back to this, they're not as unified a block as the way the Southeastern Conference or the Big 10 is. By the way, neither one of those institutions is as unified as I would have said they were 2 or 3 years ago. We're on the precipice of significant change. The Big 12 is essentially a collection of individual entities. It's sort of the midpoint, the way station, right? The layover between
but have
and
have not. But
I would argue
that the Big 12 has the most like membership of any of these conferences.
For the time being.
Correct. But what if Texas Tech moves on and joins some other consortium? I'm just worried you guys are all sort of ginning yourself up into this idea of, well, we're going to borrow against this because, of course, we're going to make it back in TV dollars. If you pull a couple pieces off this current Big 12, guys, basketball is not going to save you from a television revenue standpoint. Okay, I've had more than one person tell me that throughout my career. It's great that you're the best basketball league. I don't know anything about basketball. I really don't. I enjoy watching the tournament, and that's pretty much where it stops for me. But I do know this, that every person I talk to says basketball revenue will not drive a TV rights negotiation. It will 10%. Not drive 10%, 10%. Thank you, Ross. Yes.
So that's not probably crazy. A high number depending on who you talk to.
Okay, so man, this feels foreboding, but good luck. Some of y'all are going to be underwater in a couple years.
All right, enjoy financing your chicken and rice bowl.
Not even getting the tortilla now. Jeez.
I'm hungry now.
listen, you got to cut costs somewhere, Godfrey. Guys, Utah is one of the schools most heavily involved in this. Ross detailed the deal they made. Utah also has a huge shakeup in its football program because one of the longest tenured coaches in college football is retiring after the bowl game. We'll talk about that when we come back. We're back at the College Football Inquirer, and Ross Dellinger and Stephen Godfrey asked me the same thing that you probably did when you heard me say in the tease for this segment that a legendary long-tenured coach is retiring. I probably should not have used that word in reference to Kyle Whittingham, who is stepping down as Utah's coach after the bowl game, because I don't know that he's necessarily retiring. This is a man who's worked out 2,558 days, and it might be actually longer than that. I'm just making up that number. But this is a man who does not look like he's slowing down anytime soon, even though he's 66 years old. So maybe retirement might be the wrong word, but Kyle Whittingham will no longer be the Utah coach after the bowl game.
Yeah. Well, in you read the statement sort of sent out by the school, and it specifically used the vocabulary of stepping down. This has been, I can't remember, Morgan Scully was named the head coach in waiting, 3 years ago-ish, maybe?
I feel like he was in line for it for the last 10
For a
years.
While. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so this has been going on for a while. Every December, there's a conversation between Utah's administration and Kyle Whittingham about his future. And I think a lot of people, because they went 5-7 last season, thought that it would happen. And he didn't want to go out like that. And so they went 10-2 this year. And I think the conversation's been had for the last week or two with Kyle Whittingham, the same conversation that's been had the last few years. Of, hey, would you sort of give up this part? If you remain head coach, can you give up this part? Can you give up this to Morgan? And because Morgan obviously wanted, he agreed to this. And as Godfrey will probably speak to in a bit, when you're head coach and waiting, you think you're going to be head coach in the next year or two. And it kept dragging on and on and on. He turned down other jobs, I think, Morgan Scully did. And so I would love to get the inside details on exactly how this conversation went, but pretty clearly, since they didn't use the words retiring in the statement, this is not fully something Kyle Whittingham wanted to do.
Does this ever work? Does this ever work? Our generation of
Jimbo
sports
Fisher
writer,
won a national title.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's true. That's it.
It worked.
But boy, it was ugly.
But boy, was it nasty.
They had to force out Bobby Bowden at the end of the 2009 season.
They had to force out a statue. So while, it's funny because I'm working on something right now that involves Jimbo Fisher's ascent in college football. But when he lands in Tallahassee, that wasn't a given. It felt like you had an obvious successor in place. And so they said that either the supplicant or the incumbent someone doesn't want to align with the obvious timeline. So in this case, I don't know if it's obvious that Kyle Whittingham should step down, but I do know that if you've made this
public- I don't think it's obvious at all that he should step down. No. I think they had horrible quarterback injury luck for 2 years.
Right.
The second they didn't have that anymore, they were 10-2. Like, the guy's still as sharp as ever.
So the ones that I was able to pull in my notes when we started talking about this, the kind of disaster that sets it off in this generation of sports writing is obviously Will Muschamp and Texas with Mac Brown, yeah. Right? That ends mm-hmm. with Will Muschamp taking over, wildly successful, after Urban Meyer steps down at Florida. Okay, so that's the one that we all remember as not working. Again, because the incumbent, the statue, the national title winning head coach, doesn't want to align with that timeline.
How about Danny Hope after Joe Tiller at Purdue?
Okay.
That was bad.
How about Wisconsin, Brett Bielema, Barry Alvarez?
That worked.
One has the opposite effect where it doesn't work, Andy, because if you talk to Brett, I think he's honest with the fact that he felt meddled with by the former head coach who was still hanging around the building.
Yeah. I'm going to raise my hand here and say Barry's meddling won them Big Ten titles. And so
Barry wasn't wrong, but Brett thought it was intrusive enough as the sort of emeritus head coach turned AD that he went to Arkansas, failed miserably, and has just now brought his career back to the Wisconsin level at Illinois. And I'm talking about like a 10, 15 year span of time. This never seems to work, guys. I don't know why this tool should be eliminated from the toolbox when it comes to athletic director engineering. I understand the delicacy involved. No, sorry, delicateness. Delicacy would be something you consume. When you are trying to move on. The one that, again, and this one didn't work either because the replacement coach was the wrong guy ultimately. I remember talking to Whit Babcock at Virginia Tech the year that it became apparent it was time for Frank Beamer, legendary, the name of Virginia Tech football, it was time for him to go. And we can talk about how it took Frank Beamer so long to build this thing and when do you know that when you're on the downside of this, all that kind of stuff. But what Frank did that was so helpful was that he went to the administration, the school president, Whit Babcock, the AD, and said, hey, this is it. And then that allowed them to work transparently on a search. It wasn't they did not hire a head coach in waiting. They just hired a head coach and conducted a search above board with the public statement being that Frank was going to step down.
Well, they also handled the Bud Foster situation because they explained to Bud he wasn't getting the job. And he ended up wanting to stay on or being willing to stay on when they hired Justin Fuente.
Of course, Justin Fuente doesn't work out. I don't really have a great example of this. And, you know, there are trees, guys. Andy, there are trees. Like, I think about the Paul Johnson tree. You know, Ken Niumatalolo taking over for Paul Johnson at Navy. And then, you know, Munkin was on those staffs. Obviously, he went to Army. I can think of trees where you have good succession. But I cannot recall a positive head coach in waiting scenario.
Ryan Day essentially was.
Okay.
But they didn't tell anybody. But Gene Smith did vet other candidates. When Urban Meyer told him he was stepping down.
I got one.
And he decided Ryan Day was the best of those candidates.
I got one, and maybe this is the qualifier, okay? And I don't even know if this is going to count, technically. You ready? Western Kentucky University.
Yeah.
Hey, do you know where I'm going? Mm-hmm. Bobby Petrino, making his comeback from the motorcycle incident, comes in as Western Kentucky's head coach, tells the AD, Todd Stewart, tells everybody, tells God, tells every hilltop in the world, I ain't long for this place. This is a step up the ladder on me getting back to the Power Five. They bring in Jeff Brohm as the, I believe, OC QB's coach, associate. Right. They give him like 9 titles. And they even, I went up there a couple times that season. And as bad
as entirely too much brain power to use in Conference USA, by the way.
Well, but damn did, so this is where I'm headed.
Yeah.
They're even telling kids in the locker room. Because Petrino at that time was famous for when he would leave a place, he would salt the earth. The kids, he would bring in kids who would only listen to him. He kind of had this mercenary attitude. And like every program would lose big after they had Bobby Petrino leave. Western Kentucky knew this. So they said, you're head coach for a year. If you can win, get out of here. Brohm is the next guy. We're going to tell every single kid that signs here, Brohm is the next guy. After Petrino left, I believe they had 10 wins or more 3 times in Western, like I think it's in successive years.
They've kind of kept it up.
Yeah. Well, Tyson Helton is a miracle worker. That's a conversation for another day because of what he does annually.
Best hire of assistants in America.
God. That guy should run a search firm. So that's the only case in which, and I only think it's because, how do I say this nicely? Bobby Petrino is such a universally renowned SOB that it actually helped the players to know that this was a tense situation and Jeff Brohm was going to be the head coach the following year. That's it, Andy. That's all I got. That's the only one I can think of.
That one works. I still think the Bielema Alvarez one is an example of one that worked. Whether it was frictionless or not is not the question. It was, did the handoff go smoothly? Did the program dip? Did the program get better? The program actually got better.
Yes. All those things are
they
true.
They had a nice run.
Yeah. I think it depends on whose story you hear over a couple cold beers. Was Brett straying away or was Barry too meddlesome?
Yeah.
Well, it's hard. It's hard. So the thing about Utah, and I understand Utah wants continuity, because remember, Kyle Whittingham was Urban Meyer's defensive coordinator at Utah when Urban Meyer left for Florida. So Kyle Whittingham was promoted. This is the same succession plan they used the last time. It's just they used it last time 21 years ago.
And he had a chance. I think of that. I'm trying to recall that year. I believe he had a chance, Kyle Whittingham, for the BYU job.
I think that's what pushed them to hire him.
Yeah.
And, you know, it worked out great. He's phenomenal. Now, if Kyle Whittingham does the Jerry Kill, I'm going to become a consigliere at some program. Mm. I'm just telling you, preseason, put the biggest future you can on that team.
Oh, man, absolutely, yeah. Especially if he were to, like Jerry Kill, not necessarily packaged with one quarter. This is what here's what we should do, Andy. You ready? All right, I got this. You know how Skylar Cassidy imported the North Texas defense that basically helps Eric Morris get the Oklahoma State job from Sam Houston. Kyle takes a year off. He starts coaching at the very, very low level, some Conference USA job, Mountain West gig. He coaches the crap out of the defense. He then joins, like Jerry Kill did at Vanderbilt, he imports a defense rather than a quarterback because he's a defensive guy, and watch the future skyrocket there. If he followed the Jerry Kill method, it would work on defense.
Well, I think you should go to the same state that Jerry Kill went to. Like, just go call Jason Eckett in New Mexico and say, Jason, let me just help you out in any way I can.
Yeah. Oof.
Because Jason Eckett's going to wind up in the Big Ten next year. And
Yeah. Especially if look out. Especially if Wisconsin doesn't get it together.
That's the one, you'd think.
Oof. So again, I apologize, Kyle Whittingham, for using the R word, because I suspect that you probably aren't. And
still got some in the tank.
I don't want to bench press against him right now. That's for sure.
I don't ever want to bench press.
I don't know if he still got the. Does he still have the streak going of the workout?
The streak is not broken, as far as I know. I talked to him about it at Big 12 Media Days.
Wait, how old is he?
66. How old is he?
That's so demoralizing. I'm 22 years younger than him, and if I work out 3 days in a row, I all but like proclaim to the world I'm going to take a day off the gym. That's pathetic.
And he's I believe he's like a double black diamond skier. Too.
Yes. Also a very good tennis player, I believe.
I bet. You know what? Renaissance man. I'm sure he makes his own whiskey in his garage and wrestled a bear and all that stuff too. Yeah.
Yeah. Probably he doesn't strike me as a craft beer guy because he would have way more of a gut if he were craft beer.
Yeah. That's true. Yeah. He just wants to, he's straight for the alcohol consumption.
Gentlemen, this has been a pleasure. We will be back Tuesday. We keep pushing the Godfrey Saves the Bowl segment because news keeps happening. I think Godfrey's going to save the Bulls on Tuesday, but I'm going to tell you, Michigan's still looking for a football coach. So there's a very good chance that could dominate our conversation on Tuesday. So trust me, it'll be a fun
conversation. It's a conspiracy, Andy. Let's just be honest. The Bull Industrial Complex keeps pushing back the truth. Let's be honest.
I know you've got some great ideas. I cannot wait to hear it, and I know everybody else can't wait to hear it.
I'm going to power wash this thing.
I'm going to tell you right now, if Michigan hires a coach...
Yeah, we ain't doing it.
We have to wait again. We'll talk to you on Tuesday.